Stand, please. Oye, oye, oye. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 10-3072. Increase the certifying of the United States
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. The district court employed a summary civil procedure that did not comply with Criminal Rule 42 to adjudicate a finding of criminal contempt. The contempt was criminal in nature because the totality of the circumstances show that the district court adjudicated Ms. Morris and Mr. Welch in contempt for a completed act of disobedience in order to vindicate the court's authority. This backward-looking nature of the contempt demonstrates that the primary purpose was punitive and therefore the contempt was criminal. Now let me run through those circumstances. First, by the time the court made its adjudication, there was nothing to coerce. In his colloquy with the court, before the court held anyone in contempt, Mr. Driscoll said that the documents that had been omitted would be produced forthwith. Second, the court was acting to vindicate its authority for a completed act of disobedience. If you focus in on what the court says at JA 114, the court says, that was a court order. I said, turn the documents over or invoke the privilege. And you're telling me there was no reason why they weren't turned over, so I'm holding the team of attorneys responsible for that with contempt of court.
Amicus takes you to task, of course, by focusing on certain statements by the district court, saying that's not what we're supposed to look at.
Your Honor, I profoundly disagree with that. You have nothing else to look at but what the district court said.
Well, what he did.
Excuse me?
What he did.
What he did and what he said. And what he did here was hold these individual attorneys, not the government at large, but he held these individual attorneys in contempt because they had failed to comply with his order. Now, to be sure, the court also said, I want the documents turned over by the close of business. But the cases are very clear that when an order of contempt contains both a punitive criminal element and a coercive civil element, the criminal element predominates for purposes of determining the nature of the contempt on review in the Court of Appeals.
And the criminal element here is the statement about the authority of the court and I'll take care of sanctions later?
The sanction that was imposed on February 13th was the finding that your conduct is outrageous and not acceptable, and that's why I'm holding you in contempt. That's at JA 116. It's this causal connection between the failure to comply and the finding of contempt that imposes a reprimand. It imposed opprobrium.
Why would the district court appoint someone to investigate, pursue the possibility of criminal contempt?
Why did he do that?
If this was the criminal contempt,
that came 2 months later, Your Honor. After the government disclosed that there was additional exculpatory material that had not been produced, and it moved to dismiss the case and did not seek to retry it. At that point, the district judge appointed a prosecutor to look into whether there had been any willful contempt in disobedience of the court.
Are you suggesting that it could not be civil contempt unless the district court had said, I'll give you until 5 o'clock to produce the documents, and if you don't, you'll be in contempt?
That's
the only way it could happen?
I'm not saying it's the only way, but it's one way that it could happen.
Another way it could happen is the district court says, I'm holding you in contempt, and I want those documents here by 5 o'clock. or you'll face serious penalties. Or I want them by 5 o'clock, and I'll charge you $100 for every hour after 5 o'clock. Or I want them by 5 o'clock, and depending upon when you get them here or not, I'll decide what the appropriate sanction is.
Those would have been coercive orders. But we get to yet another one of the circumstances, which...
But wait, any one of those would be civil, right? Properly civil contempt.
Correct, except that your last item, that I'll then decide what sanctions are appropriate.
Yeah.
Well, those sanctions could turn out to be criminal. We'd have to wait and see what the...
It could or could not. But,
right.
But the court is saying it could be civil, right?
Yes, but the court...
So that I haven't stated as a judge precisely what the result will be doesn't foreclose the possibility that it's civil contempt.
Correct.
Right, so you have the possibility of purging it. And if you knock it all out and do what the judge asked, then the judge has suggested nothing is a distinct part. You are protecting yourself if you do what I ask you to do.
Correct, but here, Judge, there was no conditional, this will happen if you don't turn them over by 5 o'clock. There was none of that in this order.
It says, I'll make a determination on penalties later.
He said what sanctions will be imposed.
Sanctions,
yes.
Later, right.
But then we get to the next factor, and all of these, I think, need to be taken
into account. It actually says appropriate sanctions, so it may turn out, as it turned out, that the court found no sanctions appropriate.
20 months after the fact, it decided not to impose any additional sanctions. But this blot on the reputations of these attorneys...
Well, wait, that depends on whether you're right, whether it's criminal.
Right? Correct.
Okay, because we don't have any... We can't take an appeal if it's civil. It's beyond our jurisdiction.
Right.
So you're jumping ahead.
All right, well, let me...
If it's civil... You know, that it may be that they're saddened by the fact that they were in the middle of all of that. But we don't have jurisdiction to hear it. If the district court's right, it's been purged, it's over. They may feel, well, you know, that's a blot in my mind on my record, but you don't have an appealable blot.
Well, let's go to the next factor. The documents were turned over within 3 hours of the hearing. An email was sent to Chambers saying that the documents had been turned over. And on Friday evening, the district judge responded and said, thank you. The next day, the court entered a minute order which removed Mr. Driscoll, one of the attorneys, from the contempt order of the previous day and confirmed that Ms. Morris and Mr. Welch were in contempt because it was their responsibility to see that the documents were produced, and they had failed to comply with the court's orders.
Can I ask you about this? So Driscoll was not removed because he purged his contempt, right? He was removed because the court, on reconsideration, concluded that he was never liable in the first place.
Correct.
Correct? Now, I appreciate you sent an email, or client sent an email. Was there a motion to purge the contempt in light of compliance?
No, there wasn't, Your Honor.
Well, so... Court gets a lot of papers, and most courts are driven by the motions in front of them. And I think you might have an argument if you had moved for purging and the district court had said, no, you're in contempt, tough luck, you can't be purged. But you didn't do that. All you did was, if at all we have is an email, which I trust is correct, but it's not part of the court record, advising the court of compliance. Well, the next thing that should be done is you should move for purging, and nobody did that. In fact, the first time that anybody moved to purge the contempt was Ms. Stemler's motion, which the court eventually granted.
Correct. And in that order, recharacterized what had happened on February 13th.
Well, that's the bottom line question for us. But I don't think that you get anything out of the fact that the court didn't do anything until somebody asked it to do something.
Well, I think if you take all the circumstances into account, the documents are produced by the end of the day. The judge has said that he's going to wait till the end of the case. He didn't say till they were produced. He said, I'm going to wait till the end of the case. That's an important factor to decide what sanctions are imposed.
No, whether any sanctions are appropriate.
Correct. That
makes a big difference.
But at the end of the case, Judge.
So what?
The very end of the case.
I mean, I would feel if I was sitting as a district court judge, any half-smart attorney is going to understand there's something at stake here. You can relieve yourself of a lot of problems if you get these documents in on time. 5 o'clock is my deadline. I'll think about the appropriateness of sanctions later. Like Judge Garland says, there's too much stuff on my plate. I can't deal with that now. But you certainly are warned as an attorney. You certainly have every incentive now to deliver, right?
Yes, but look at it from the attorney's point of view, Judge. They've been in front of a very angry judge on Friday who says, I'm going to determine what sanctions are appropriate at the end of the case. I don't want to get sidetracked. I'm going to deal with the defense's post-trial motions. I'm going to deal with this at the end of the case. The documents are produced. If that purged, if that in fact purged the contempt, then the order on the 14th doesn't make any sense, because the court is saying, continuing to say, that Morris and Welch are in contempt because they disobeyed my order.
Well, I think I have to admit that tactically you don't want to get in the face of the district judge who's angry at you. That seems perfectly right. But so they correctly didn't do that. And in fact, they got in the end not a bad disposition, which is a determination by the district judge that this was civil and not criminal. And they got it by the very good strategy of not waiting. Now, this raises for me the following question. You have very good lawyers on your side in this case. I don't understand the strategy. If you win, if we decide this is criminal, we are going to send it back for a trial. And then, I don't know, maybe you think it's impossible that your clients could get convicted, but there is at least a chance that your clients will be convicted. If you lose, we'll hold that it's civil, and then you will not have a criminal conviction. So do you really want us to hold it criminal and have on their record a blot that this was a criminal conviction and then leave it for the district judge maybe or maybe not to acquit?
What we want is an order vacating this finding of
criminal. I read that, but next.
And then there's no need to send this back, Your Honor, because if there are any need for further proceedings, Mr. Schulke will take care of that.
Well, you didn't cite any cases after the sentence saying just vacate and don't remand. And I've looked at lots of these cases, and they all end with a remand for further proceedings. You say in one sentence, it's too late, it's too long ago. We're well within the general 5-year statute of limitations for a criminal case, and there's some doubt about whether any statute of limitations applies here. So I don't understand. Explain to me the strategy. I think you're going to lose on the following question. If we were to decide this was criminal, I think we would have to remand for a trial. Now, is that really what you want?
No, we don't want that, and you don't have to.
So then maybe you don't want to win here. Maybe you want us to say this is clearly civil, and now you don't have the criminal blot on your record.
I have the same question.
You're all struggling with that.
I have no idea why this is here.
Well,
I don't understand your strategy at all. Judge Garland has stated it for me.
Why is this here? Put yourself in the position of Mr. Morris and Ms. Welch. They regularly have to sign certifications saying whether they've been held in contempt. They then have to describe the nature of the contempt. Now, were they held in criminal contempt or were they held in civil contempt?
The district court said it was civil. And in fact, if you'd like, we could say it was civil. But if we do that, you've lost what you asked for. But is this really what you want? You really want us to tell you you're wrong, it's civil?
That order was so procedurally defective, it never should have been entered, and it should be vacated for that purpose. Now, additionally...
You mean the original order?
Which order?
The February 13th order. The order holding them in criminal contempt.
The order holding them in contempt.
Yes.
Telling them to turn the document over by close of business.
Yes, and also saying that...
Think about...
Which part of it was inappropriate? The district court couldn't insist that I want documents?
The part that says I'm holding you in contempt because you didn't obey my orders, your conduct has been outrageous and unacceptable, and that's why I'm holding you in contempt.
When you say you have to fill out on the bar form what kind of contempt, why would your clients not be comfortable saying civil, comma, because that's what the district court said?
In a published opinion.
Yeah.
That's what the Court of Appeals obviously agreed, because they dismissed for want of jurisdiction.
If you lost.
Well, it certainly would be a comfort if this court said it. But
Why isn't it enough if the district court said it?
Your Honor, as you say, a lot of lawyers have looked at this, and we don't think that Mr. Welch and Ms. Morris can say with a straight face that what happened on February 13th was merely a finding of civil contempt.
So do you think you would win a victory? Would it be a victory then for you if we were to say no jurisdiction because this is civil, and from now on you can write down civil? Is that really all you're asking?
I'm not getting this at all. I'm really not. Like Colin said, there's smart counsel on your side. If a court of appeals dismisses for want of jurisdiction because it's civil, you have two courts saying this was civil contempt, purged moot.
Your briefs don't give us any explanation for what the you don't even address the question of what the harm of a civil contempt would be. And in the footnote, you say you're not, you know, in the reply brief, and I think accurately, you say you're raising that issue. So we have, I'm at a loss to understand.
Can I go back to this point about a remand? This is a very unusual case in its posture. Our position, and I think this is a very strong position, that because Mr. Schulke has been appointed as a special prosecutor and he has the authority to recommend criminal contempt as to anything that happened in the court, it's taken care of.
Let me ask you, what about the district court's footnote 1 in his October 12th opinion, where he limits Mr. Schulke?
He says that Ms. Stemler is not included.
The court wishes to be clear that Ms. Stemler was not one of the attorneys identified as part of that investigation, and this civil contempt finding was unrelated to the events that led to the appointment of Mr. Schulke.
It's true. Ms. Stemler was not, she's right. Not under the Schulke
right.
Order. But Mr. Schulke has the jurisdiction or the authority to look into everything that happened, including whether there was a willful criminal contempt in with respect to these events that came to a head in February 13. 2009.
How does he have, if the district court has said he can't look into it with respect to Ms. Stemler, and the only event that Ms. Stemler was found in contempt for was the same event we're speaking about today, obviously couldn't look into it for your clients either with respect for that the
right.
event on that day.
Well,
so he would have, the district court would have to make another referral.
You need to keep the chronology, you know, in perspective. This happened, this February 13th adjudication of contempt took place. Then on April 7th, the court dismissed the case on the government's motion, and at that point appointed Mr. Schulke and gave him authority to look into everything. Then in 2010, the court decided, then after that point, Ms. Stemler makes her motion, and then in 2010, the court denies Ms. Stemler's motion. The question of the production of these emails has not been taken away from Mr. Schulke.
Well, what did district court mean when he said that Ms. Stemler is not before Mr. Schulke?
Because when he appointed Mr. Schulke, he appointed Mr. Schulke only with respect to Welch, Morris, Bettini, Sullivan, Ketke, and Marsh. He specifically identified the attorneys.
And why did he separate her out from them unless it was because he meant that the events on that day were not criminal?
There's no way to tell that because Ms. Stemler hadn't made any submission. No submission had been made on this production of email issue at the time the court appointed Mr. Schulke.
So your win is vacator, and then Mr. Schulke can't touch
That's right.
Cannot touch his conduct?
He can't. No, he can. Mr. Schulke has
so you're happy
enormous
to put
authority.
You're happy to put your fate in the hands of Mr. Schulke. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I see. And what if the district court appoints another prosecutor just for this issue, one whose fate you're not so happy to put your hands in? And maybe even further, if Mr. Schulke decides not to prosecute, is the district court bound?
The district court can certainly make its own decision. I suppose it could replace Mr. Schulke if he, you know, but these are all events that have yet to unfold.
I know, and that's why it seems to me when you have civil contempt in your hand, Why are you reaching for the bush with criminal contempt?
Again, Your Honor, because we don't think that these attorneys with a straight face can tell any disciplinary authority.
That just makes no sense. I really respectfully, and I do mean this respectfully, if you have two courts on the record who have said otherwise, the straight face argument to me is utterly frivolous. They absolutely can say they have not been held in criminal contempt.
If we get this court, Judge,
we would have to, if we went with civil, we would have to dismiss for want of jurisdiction and say, because it's civil, they would absolutely be able to write on any form from here on in for the rest of their lives that they had not been held in criminal contempt, at least not in this proceeding.
Yeah, but you've added something here, Judge, which is this court's imprimatur, which at least at this point we don't have. I mean, when you look at what Judge Sullivan, not whatever gloss this court may add to it, but when you just look at what Judge Sullivan did, it sure looks...
But see, you only want to look at part of what he did. In October, I know you don't want to look at his recharacterization, but he does say in his published opinion, this was civil, it's been purged, and a non-pro-tunk lifting.
He does say that, Your Honor, but a district court can't recharacterize a finding and insulate itself from review, which is one thing that's happening. I'm not attributing any intent, but that's effectively, if that scenario is the correct one, that's what's happening here. The court is insulating itself. He slams these attorneys, he assaults their professional reputations, and he says, oh, it was really civil, so nobody can appeal this.
All right, but counsel, let's go back. I mean, litigating attorneys of all stripes are not immune to the frustration of trial courts.
We're not always so good ourselves.
I was going to say, much less appellate.
He's smiling courts. Before the judge even finishes the question.
Yeah. So you have harsh words, and you have the statement about, and I'll consider any appropriate sanctions later. Then you have the February 14th order, which is, what, your strongest point here?
I think that's one of our strongest points, along with the backward-looking, authority-vindicating nature of what the court did on the 13th.
But, I mean, the judge says you violated an order to turn over these documents. Turn them over by 5 o'clock. Now, it's backward-looking only to the extent that the order has been violated. But there's a prospective action.
There is, and the cases that are cited in the briefs are quite clear that when there's both a civil and a criminal aspect or element to a contempt finding, for purposes of review on appeal, the criminal element fixes the character and predominates.
Do we want to hear from amicus?
I haven't cut into Ms. Stetson's time.
No, it's all right. You haven't. Can I just ask a couple more questions? So what words would have been sufficiently non-harsh to not be criminal, but sufficiently strong to get across the point of the district court's displeasure? So the two words we're talking about here are outrageous and not acceptable.
And
you don't really think not acceptable isn't good enough, do you?
Well, outrageous is the stronger of the two. But you see, there, Judge, too, judges have probably told me that I've been outrageous and done things unacceptable, but they didn't then
say... Lawyers have said that about us, too.
And they didn't then say, and therefore, I'm holding you in contempt. Causal connection, this goes, I meant to say this in response to you, Judge Rogers, this causal connection is very important.
What if the court had said, and therefore I'm holding you in civil contempt?
That would have been very clear.
Exact same words, but said civil.
And if the court had said, if these documents aren't produced by 5 o'clock...
Wait, do you have to add all that? Suppose the court just said, I'm holding you in civil contempt.
It would have been helpful to know what the coercive penalty was going to be, or the coercive.
But you already agreed the judge doesn't have to state the penalty.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's the other point here. Driscoll. I mean, the government may have made some mistakes here, but you have Mr. Driscoll standing up in open court, and an officer of the court saying these documents will be produced forthwith. There really wasn't anything coerced.
Well.
Well, you could say, all right.
You can't believe, you can't believe that.
He said he'd already issued an order directing these documents.
So then...
What, is the attorney going to stand up there and say, I won't?
Well, if they were asserting privilege, they might.
Well,
they might
I'm just saying, I won't, not I'm asserting privilege.
Now, I understand your point about you don't want to face, in Judge Garland's words, an angry judge, but there was a lot of time to file a motion.
Well, but see, then you have Schulke kicks in April, and he's conducting an investigation. He's going to make a report and recommendation of some sort.
Well, I mean, due respect, the judge may have been angry on the 13th and the 14th. I mean, you could have filed before the 7th.
Oh, he got even angrier in April.
Yeah. So your argument is because a judge gets angry, that excuses the failure to file?
I don't think I want to put it quite that way, Your Honor.
Well, I'm trying to understand
why,
what is the line.
When I was asked, you know, why didn't they file a motion asking for the contempt to be purged, I think the good reason for that is that the court was still had the Damocles sword of sanctions to be addressed.
Right.
I'm delighted to keep answering questions, but I think maybe I ought to sit down.
Do I have the right order?
Yes, amicus is next.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Rogers, and may it please the court. Once the judge purged the contempt, this appeal became moot.
If it's civil.
If it's civil, and this one is civil, and in that regard, there are no other sanctions imposed, and I don't believe there is contempt by adjective. I think what the judge did was, if anything, from any other lawyer's standpoint, and the court's brought up the issue, why do you want to have the court rule so that you have to say you've been convicted of crime, but you beat the rap on appeal, essentially, rather than saying you were found in civil contempt, complied with the order, and that was the end of it?
Well, you're probably more familiar than I, but I've read enough to know that these lines aren't always that distinct. And the argument, as I understand it, is here you have a judge who's very upset. He issues an order, and then the next day he reaffirms, even though the documents have been turned over and the government, at least by an email we're told, has notified the judge of this fact. Nevertheless, the judge reaffirms the civil contempt. And as counsel said just a moment ago, the judge had said, I'm going to consider any appropriate sanctions later.
The answer to the question, I think what happened on the 14th is, and it's been characterized that way in the course of my colleague's argument, judge reconsidered and decided Driscoll really didn't have any place in this at all, so he let Driscoll out. Other than that, he let stand what he had said the day before, which was, you're in contempt and I'm going to figure out the sanctions later. Now, I think for most judges in a situation where you don't get held in contempt because everything is going along fine. Both either a civil contempt or a criminal contempt have consequences for lawyers, but the fact that the judge didn't want to rule in the heat of the moment, if anything, operates to the benefit of most lawyers, because ultimately lawyers are going to be better off in the end if the judge decides it's a civil contempt and purges it. And that's what you have here. All the other issues...
It would be a lot clearer if the court had said, if you comply by a close of business, it will be purged. Right?
Absolutely, Judge Garland. There's no question about that. It would be clearer. But what the decisions say, because it's hard to figure out whether a contempt is civil or criminal, regardless of whether the judge labels it or not, what you look at are the sanctions. The sanctions drive whether it's criminal or civil contempt, because the sanctions have to stay within the judge's authority to use the civil contempt.
But in Cobell, we took harsh language as being the sufficient sanction.
You took harsh language because four of the five contempts were for prior conduct that could not be purged. And the fifth one, you very carefully recognized, well, there was some room for this to be purged, but the judge did not say it was purged. And because the judge did not say it was purged, it could not be purged, and that's why it was contumacious.
Actually, the judge said it wasn't purgeable. Even better for you.
Even better for me. I mean, the fact that here, Judge Sullivan ultimately said it is a purged contempt and I'm imposing no sanctions ends it. It is not an issue for this court, and most lawyers...
Is it always okay for the judge later to redefine, leave out the word redefine because that answers the question, but to clarify in that way any length of time later?
Let me answer that in two ways. One way is I don't think there's anything wrong with the judge putting off the decision. As to the length of time, as the court has already pointed out, they have to file something. If they're concerned about the length of time, they can file a motion. Ms. Stemler filed a motion asking for a ruling in July of 2010. They could file a motion asking for purging whatever they wanted. There are strategical reasons why they may not have wanted a ruling. When this case when the conviction was vacated and the charges dismissed in April, and one other thing while I've got it, the charges in Capel are more like the charges that Judge Sullivan referred to the private prosecutor, not what we have here. But the point is that it doesn't make a difference. If it's ultimately purged, that's the end of the matter. If time becomes an issue, file a motion. If the judge still doesn't do anything, file a petition for a writ of mandamus. That's the way that's tested. But there's also something lurking here that sort of isn't on the table, which is there are collateral consequences to lawyers when they're held in contempt, be it civil or criminal. And some courts have recognized because of those collateral consequences, lawyers may sometimes be allowed to appeal a civil contempt. They have expressly disavowed any interest in asking this court for that type of special rule. That's where these special concerns of lawyers that are incidental to any contempt come in. They don't come in making it criminal, and it would do almost every other lawyer except these two would not want a decision from this court that forced judges to hold people in criminal contempt. The civil contempt option should be there. The judge should have the right, Judge Golden, to change his mind, essentially to reduce it down to something that is much less harmful to most lawyers. Whatever their strategy is here, as the court has indicated, it is not a strategy that well serves the rest of the bar or the bench for that matter, because the judges have to have some latitude. They don't have to worry about everything they say in the course of a proceeding, although I think to describe conduct as outrageous is probably the threshold you'd need for a civil contempt. Judge is not going to hold a lawyer in civil contempt for conduct that is anything less than outrageous because there are consequences. And so for that reason, I just don't think there's anything here. The judge was operating within the scope of his authority. They have raised their first appearances after the dismissal. They filed their appeal. They have not preserved issues with regard to the 20-month delay. The only issue they have preserved is does it have to be incanted at the time that this will be purged if you do it? That doesn't change the course of aspect of this. This is very much coercive. There was still something to be done. They had not filed things they should have filed. They were in contempt of an order, and it's now been purged. That's, as far as I can see, the end of the case.
Do you agree that if this is seen as criminal, that the appeal is timely filed?
No. We think if it's a criminal under the analysis that you have to use, they had 14 days to appeal under Rule 4, and they didn't do it.
Well, 14A is not jurisdictional.
That's correct. You would have discretion.
And one ground for discretion would be equitable, and one ground for equitable discretion is confusion. And this is like the Duell case, which just exactly what we want an amex to do, which is to cite cases that aren't always in support, where it's difficult to tell for sure, and where that's really the ultimate issue. We could give the appellant the benefit of the doubt on that until we resolve the question.
That's correct. There's no question this is not jurisdictional. We haven't made that argument. You'd have discretion. They haven't asked you to exercise the discretion. They absolutely say that part of the rule doesn't apply. But let me take it one step further with that. What Duell was dealing with was when does the order become appealable?
But why is that really different?
Well, the difference is here, by the time we're into this contempt proceeding and the actual adjudication of it, the rest of the case is done. We're on a miscellaneous docket. We're on our own docket. We are the case. We are the contempt. If you are going to go up on appeal and tell the Court of Appeals that this is a criminal case and I have been wrongfully convicted, what we're saying is, okay, file your appeal in 14 days. That's what the rule says. That's the way you drew the distinction back. You look at the character of the proceeding. If they're saying that the character of the proceeding is, I was held in criminal contempt and I'm appealing that order, that's where we have our argument that it's 14 days. As for exercising inequitable, sure, you have that power. They haven't asked you to exercise it. And we are dealing here with senior attorneys in the Department of Justice who are quite familiar with these rules. So I'm not sure if they're not going to ask for that type of equitable discretion. They have essentially said we rise and fall on our claim that this is subject to the 30 or 60 day provision, and that's their argument. But obviously, the court has the power.
In their reply brief, they come back with that same case, the Duell case.
Right? They come back with the Duell case, but I think they're looking at more, we get the 30 days. They have not made an argument that if it's 14 days, we win. So if the court says the 14 days doesn't apply at all, of course
I'm going to. No, but it's, in a way, the argument is, until we know what it is, it's the 30-day rule.
And I think that it could be framed that way. I don't think you have to, because I think the way you do it is you look at the character. You have to make that decision. But lawyers oftentimes have a case where they're not sure which of 2 days applies. And I think we all know what you do in that situation. One final point I want to make, and then if there are questions, of course, I'll answer them. Footnote 1 on page 133, the judge makes it very clear, because it's two findings. First, he says that Ms. Stemler is part of it. Then he says, this civil contempt finding was unrelated to the events that led to the appointment of Mr. Schulke. Under those circumstances, and in a certain sense, this probably, again, is more beneficial to them, it really has to go back to Judge Sullivan to decide whether or not he wants to refer it to Schulke or what he wants to do, because he may not even want to refer it. If, in fact, he thinks it's a civil contempt, but the court tells him it's a criminal contempt, he may well not want to refer it at all. But that's his decision to make in the first instance.
See, it sounds like the opposing counsel is more happy with Mr. Schulke.
Does seem that way, but I think that may be what they're happy with, is Judge Sullivan's order to be reversing, and it's the decision that he would have to make. And it's a decision he's entitled to make. So unless there are further questions from the court,
thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Kate Stetson, doing rebuttal for the appellants. I want to begin with the analytical loop that we were talking about with respect to this, whether this is civil or criminal and why we've appealed. I think we can concede, and I think Mr. Lynch correctly did concede, that if you all conclude that this was a civil contempt as later characterized by the district judge and you dismiss for want of jurisdiction on that basis, finding it purged, that is in some respect a win for us. It's true. But the problem is, we know from Cobell, and we know from Mine Workers versus Bagwell and other cases, that the district judge's label that he attaches to the proceeding, particularly when it's 20 months after the fact, is not necessarily controlling. And if you look at a snapshot of the circumstances as they existed on February 13th, 2009, not October 20th, 2010, what we submit you would conclude is that these appellants were held in their personal capacities, no less, not the government as a party, but these lawyers as themselves were held in criminal contempt. Mr. Lynch has already pointed to the several reasons why that's so, but I want to emphasize.
Just interrupt for 1 second. I want to be sure I understood. When you said, the way you began, were you saying that it would be a win if we were to decide that, and the further explanation was why you were uncertain whether it was criminal or civil below? Or is this a further argument that it's not enough to win by having us say it's civil?
I think it's a concession that if you all conclude that it's civil, that is in some respect a win. You all were expressing some confusion about why we were here. And, you know, if you all conclude that this was civil and you dismiss for want of jurisdiction, that in some respects is a win for us. And I'd like to touch briefly on the remand issue in a moment. But my subsequent argument has to do with the fact that when it comes to the labeling, of course, what Judge Sullivan elected to call this proceeding in October of 2010 is not controlling. What happened in February of 2009 was that he summarily held these individual lawyers in criminal contempt. Now, to your questions, Judge Edwards, about the fact that Judge Sullivan may or may not have promised later sanctions, I want to refer you to Joint Appendix 114 and 115 and 116. And these, of course, are the pages at the heart of the appeal. And what he says in the first instance, you're quite right. He says, I'll deal with whatever sanctions are appropriate at the conclusion of this case. JA 115. These lawyers are held in contempt, and there will be further proceedings at the appropriate time. JA 116, I'll deal with the sanctions associated with the contempt at a later date. So one of those three is conditional. The other two are a promise. So when it comes to...
He promised to deal with it, which he had already said, it means whatever is appropriate. He wasn't saying anything that was larger or more threatening in the second two.
Well, I think
self-servingly you suggested that, but I don't see it.
Well, I think Judge Edwards, I think we're coming close to doing what Amicus correctly has admonished us not to do, which is to psychoanalyze the district judge. But what we know from the district judge's statements is that he held these individual lawyers in contempt. He directed that he would deal with the sanctions at a later date. And at one point he said whatever sanctions are appropriate, but two other times he said, I will get to these proceedings later.
Your side has conceded that the fact that the district court judge says, I'm holding you in contempt, it's at that moment, is neither here nor there. It certainly doesn't cut against civil. And it's okay to delay the determination on sanctions. That's okay. And in this case, what you all keep forgetting is he then said, and I want something at a time certain.
He did.
Very consistent with a lot of civil. This is not like Cobell. This case is so far from Cobell. It's like night and day. And I think you all have been wise to steer clear of it, except to say labeling doesn't matter. I agree, labeling doesn't matter, but this is not Cobell.
Well, it's not Cobell in this respect. You're right, Judge Edwards. You know, in Cobell, you had four completed past acts of disobedience and one that was, you know, purgeable, but maybe not. Here, we can concede that there was an act still to be performed, the documents were to be turned over, and of course, as Mr. Lynch has argued, the judge, at the point where he held these lawyers in personal contempt of court, had already received a commitment from a lawyer standing in front of him as an officer of the court that those documents would be turned over forthwith. That's the language the lawyer used. So query whether the coercive sanction was necessary. But even if it were so, the Penfield case out of the Supreme Court and even Duell versus Duell both involve circumstances where there was a sanction found to be punitive. In Penfield, it was just a $50 fine. But there was still something to be done, documents to be turned over, money to be paid, discovery to be taken. So it's not the line between Cobell's fully completed past acts of disobedience and this case, where you had a sanction that was clearly based on these attorneys' perceived willful disobedience of a court order is not that clear.
There was no sanction.
Our contention is that the contempt itself was the sanction, Your Honor.
As well as criminal?
Well, in this respect, this was a criminal contempt sanction. I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
The mere statement of a civil contempt is a sanction?
The mere statement of a civil contempt, I think, is a civil contempt. But the problem with this case is that what the judge repeatedly said was, I am adjudicating these attorneys, that's JA 116, I am adjudicating them in contempt of court. Because they don't have a good reason for not having turned over these documents. That is quintessentially a completed act.
A picture that you see with civil contempt cases where someone has performed or not performed in certain ways and the court says, I've had enough.
Very true.
And I'm holding you in civil contempt. I'm putting the civil in. And I expect this to end by X, whatever moment it is. Your co-counsel has already said that scenario is perfectly okay, and it would have been perfect if the judge used the word civil. So I'm not getting it.
I agree that if the judge had said civil contempt, and if he had made it clear that there was a purge condition attached to it, then we might be in a different category. But we already know the labeling. Sorry.
Go ahead.
We already know the labeling, even if it occurs at the time, as it did with Cobell, or 20 months later, as it did here, the labeling can't control the inquiry. What matters here is that, yes, we can concede that the district judge, in the course of this three-page colloquy with counsel, said, I want those documents turned over by close of business today, and my definition is 5 o'clock. But what you ask yourselves when you review the nature of a contempt order is, what was the primary function of this contempt citation? Was it to punish, or was it to coerce? So the fact that this has an element of coercion in it is not relevant.
The punishment is what, in your view, on February 13th? And let me say, I'm asking that question fully aware of the fact that it must be horrendous for an attorney to be held in contempt. All right. I mean, I understand that fully. And no one wants to ever have to say that a judge held them in contempt. But the law has taken us beyond that.
I think in some respects, though, Your Honor, that exactly what you said is enough. This was not...
The courts have said that that's not enough to get you to criminal contempt. That's why I want to know, what is the sanction?
What's the punishment?
The punishment in our estimation is the summary contempt holding itself, because under Cobell, it's not, and we don't need to parse whether the word outrageous was enough or whether he used harsh language. If he had used extremely temperate language and still held them in summary criminal contempt, we'd still be here.
It's not the... How do you respond to Amicus's point that you are urging a rule that encourages district court judges to hold lawyers who don't obey orders in criminal contempt, and that would almost be a hard and fast rule unless the judge uses certain magic words, namely, this is, despite everything I'm saying, only a civil contempt, and you can purge yourself of that contempt by 5 o'clock tonight?
Right. I don't think, Your Honor, that we are asking for any magic words. We're not asking for line editing of a district judge's ability, particularly in the heat of the moment, as you all have observed, to speak harshly and firmly to counsel to compel them to comply with certain court orders. But in the same vein, you know, as you've just pointed out, the word contempt has a profound significance in the law. It is not just a reprimand.
I know, but the Supreme Court has told us that that isn't enough to just say it's automatically criminal, but you're basically arguing for that rule.
In these circumstances where it is not sufficiently linked with the civil purge condition, I think that should be the rule, and I think it follows from Cobell. I don't think Cobell stands for the principle that you have to have certain words that are really, really bad attached to the contempt citation in order for it to qualify as a criminal contempt. The fact is that Cobell held that when you are talking about public officials, officers of the court, and here, as you heard Amicus say, these are senior DOJ attorneys being held in contempt in their personal capacities, no less, not the government as the party, these lawyers, these people. It should be enough under the rule of Cobell and under the basic rules of criminal procedure for that sanction, that contempt finding, as the judge said on page 115, adjudication of contempt, to be enough itself to be the criminal punishment. Now,
I wanted to continue on with Judge Rogers' point. And really Amicus's point, which is, it's not only that requires judges maybe to hold in contempt, but if we go this way, it means every attorney, not just government attorney and defense attorney, where the district court says contempt, but doesn't say which, during the period between that day and someday when you're maybe able to appeal here, you will have to tell every bar that you were held not in civil contempt, but in criminal contempt. Even if the judge a week later says, you know, I only meant that civil. I don't know how often this happens, but it does happen. And it's putting everybody in the bar at risk of having to report that they've been in criminal contempt until there's some appeal. I don't know how many years later this is now from when it actually occurred. And I think that, I mean, Cobell is an opinion of this court, which we follow. But you begin with holding somebody in jail and giving them the keys. You go, then the next step is you fine them. Okay. Then Cobell is, I think, the only case I found that is words. And now you're asking not only words, but words where the judge has said and clarified at best that it's civil, where the judge has said it's purged, where at least within the words there's some ambiguity as to whether it's purgeable or not. So if we go this step, I would think that every lawyer in the audience has to be awfully nervous about every time they might be held in contempt. It seems like a very far, far way for us to go. And is there a way to cabin that, or is that how far you think we ought to go?
No, I don't think that you need to go that distance, Your Honor, because it's not so much, again, you know, the words that the district judge used here. It's the words that he did not say. If he had said, I am holding you in, let's assume actually a expansive hypothetical. Let's assume he says, I'm holding you in contempt. He doesn't say civil or criminal, which happens. But he says, you can purge this contempt, you know, $10 a day. Contempt is purged upon turning over these documents or so forth, whatever the mandatory act is.
Magic words.
Magic words, right. You're saying, but he didn't specifically say, I'm linking the word with contempt, with purge and 5 o'clock, and there's some missing words there, and therefore we have to assume in those circumstances it's always criminal.
Our larger argument is in the context of what happened on Joint Appendix 114 through 116, and the next day, as Judge Rogers pointed out, we can draw the conclusion from that that this contempt was not extinguished. It was not purged when the documents were turned over at 5 o'clock. It remained. Well, but more to the point...
That rests so heavily on your notion that the mere use of the word contempt is punishment. And that's just a very troubling proposition. In the civil context, the judge can, as your co-counsel has said, can say, I'll determine the sanctions later. And that's all he did the next day, too. That he removed one person from that consideration says nothing.
But
he just acknowledged that this person couldn't even be part of the conversation because she wasn't involved in any way, shape, or form. But the deliberation, whatever it will produce, will be later. And he never got a motion. Now, you keep harping on these are experienced DOJ attorneys. Well, some of us think an experienced DOJ attorney would have filed a motion.
Your Honor, I am not familiar with any case that suggests that in order for a contempt to be confirmable as a civil contempt, the contemnor has to move to purge it.
I'm not aware of any case, as Judge Garland has suggested, of any case that suggests what you're saying is required in order for us to find it civil.
I think what the cases say...
You're adding wrinkles I've never found before.
No, I don't think we're adding any complexity to the rule as it currently exists. The rule as it exists asks you, what is the primary purpose of the judge's contempt citation? Was it to punish? Was it backward-looking, punishing yesterday's conduct? Or was it to compel future conduct? And all we're saying, and what we are left to argue, just as Mr. Lynch told you, is we look at what the district judge said and did at the time that contempt citation occurred, because we know the later label doesn't matter. And what the district judge did at that time was to hold these attorneys personally in summary criminal contempt. Let me make one point on the remand versus vacator issue, because I think it's an important point. We cited a case in our opening brief at page 18, U.S. versus Scrimshire out of the Fifth Circuit. We did not cite it for this proposition, but if you look at the end of Scrimshire, what the court concluded in that criminal contempt case was because the underlying trial proceedings had long since been concluded, there was nothing left to do in respect of that attorney's criminal contempt. They vacated and dismissed the proceedings, and that's what we suggest you do here.
All right, thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.